Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the Ellie Steele Show. And tonight I'm going to, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to try to go to get through. I think I'll be able to make it. I might be able to make it tonight, but I'm going to try to do the to read Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now, he's a, for those of you who may not know, Ralph Waldo Emerson is an American philosopher, thinker. But what he was, above all, I think the man was a prophet. I believe he was a prophet, and a secular prophet, but nevertheless a man of clear vision and clear understanding of universal law, without a doubt. Brilliant mind. And the significance of self-reliance, I think, today is essential, because what we have today is no more than an attempt to make people, to herd the crowd, you know, to herd the individual, break down the individual to a push toward this unity consciousness that's occurring. But the unity consciousness that's occurring now is occurring because of the times that we're in. Man has ascended to a level that we now can comprehend these things that we couldn't before. We can't imagine, overcoming the physical world with our minds. Just beyond belief. And so we're understanding the value of who we are as individuals, and not as a group think or a nation or whatever. And self-reliance is a brilliant statement made by a brilliant man who understood his own weaknesses, but at the same time understood the value of self-reliance. Man is his own star. And the soul that can render an honest and a perfect man commands all light, all influence, all fate. Nothing to him falls early or too late. Our acts, our angels are, or good or ill, our fatal shadows that walk by us still. That was the epilogue to Beaumont and Fletcher's Honest Man's Fortune. Cast the bent thing on the rocks. Suckle him with the she-wolf's teat. Wintered with the hawk and fox. Power and speed be hands and feet. I read the other day some verses written by an eminent painter, which were original and not conventional. The soul always hears an admonition in such lines, let the subject be what it may. The sentiment they instill is of more value than any thought they may contain. To believe your own thought, to believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius. Speak your latent conviction, and it shall be the universal sense, for the inmost in due time becomes the outmost, and our first thought is rendered back to us by the trumpets of the last judgment. Familiar as the voice of the mind is to each, the highest merit we ascribe to Moses, Plato, and Milton is that they set at naught books and tradition and spoke not what men, but what they thought. A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light that flashes across his mind from within, more than the luster of the firmament, the bards and sages. Yet he dismisses without notice his thought, because it is his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. Great works of art have no more affecting lessons for us than this. They teach us to abide by our spontaneous impression with good-humored inflexibility than most when the whole cry of voices is on the other side. Else tomorrow a stranger will say with masterly good sense precisely what we have thought and felt all the time, and we shall be forced to take that shame, our own opinion, from another. Or rather, we are forced to take with shame our own opinion from another. There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better, for worse, as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. The power which resides in him is new nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried. Not for nothing, one face, one character, one fact makes much impression on him, and another none. This sculpture in the memory is not without pre-established harmony. The eye was placed where one ray should fall, and it might testify of that particular ray. We but half express ourselves and are ashamed of that divine idea which each of us represents. It shall be safely trusted as proportionate and of good issue, so it be faithful imparted. But God will not have his work made manifest by cowards. A man is relieved and gay when he has put his heart into his work and done his best. But what he has said or done otherwise shall give him no peace. It is a deliverance which does not deliver, and the attempts his genius deserts him. No muse befriends, no invention, no hope. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. Accept the place the divine providence has found for you, the society of your contemporaries, the connection of events. Great men have always done so and confided themselves childlike to the genius of their age, betraying their perception that the absolute trustworthy was seated at their heart, working through their hands, predominating in all their being. And we are now men and must accept in the highest mind the same transcendent destiny, and not minors and invalids in a protected corner, not cowards fleeing before a revolution, but guides, redeemers, and benefactors, obeying the almighty effort and advances in chaos and the dark. What pretty oracles nature yields us on this text in the face and behavior of children, babes, and even brutes. That divided and rebel mind, that distrust of a sentiment, because our arithmetic has computed the strength and means opposed to our purpose, these have not. Their mind being whole, their eye is as yet unconquered, and when we look in their faces, we are disconcerted. Infancy conforms to nobody, all conform to it. So that one babe commonly makes four or five out of the adult who prattle and play to it. So God has armed youth and puberty and manhood no less with its own piquancy and charm, and made it enviable and gracious, and its claims not to be put by, if it will stand by itself. Do not think the youth has no force, because he cannot speak to you and me. Hark! In the next room his voice is sufficient, clear, and emphatic. It seems he knows how to speak to his contemporaries. Bashful or bold, then, he will know how to make us seniors very unnecessary. The nonchalance of boys, who are sure of a dinner, and would disdain as much as a lord to do or say ought to conciliate one is the healthy attitude of human nature. A boy is in the parlor with the pit, what the pit is in the playhouse, independent, irresponsible, looking out for his corner on such people and facts as pass by. He tries and sentences them on their merits in the swift, summary way of boys, as good, bad, interesting, silly, eloquent, or troublesome. He encumbers himself never about consequences, about interests. He gives an independent, genuine verdict. You must court him. He does not court you. But the man is, as it were, clapped into jail by his conscience, by his consciousness. As soon as he has once acted or spoken with éclat, he is a committed person, watched by the sympathy or the hatred of hundreds, whose affections must now enter into his account. There is no leith for this, that he could pass again into his neutrality. Who can thus avoid all pledges, and having observed again from the same unaffected, unbiased, unbribable, unaffrighted innocence, must always be formidable. He would utter opinions on all passing affairs, which, being seen to be not private but necessary, would sink like darts into the ears of men and put them in fear. These are the voices which we hear in solitude, but they grow faint and inaudible as we enter into the world. Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Society is a joint stock company in which the members agree for the better securing of his bread to each shareholder to surrender the liberty and culture of the eater. The virtue in most request is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion. It loves not realities and creators, but names and customs. Whoso would a man be, must be a nonconformist. He would gather immortal palms, he who would gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore it be goodness. Nothing is as sacred but the integrity of your own mind. Absolve you to yourself, and you shall have the suffrage of the world. I remember an answer which when quite young, I was prompted to make to a valued advisor who was wont to importune me with the dear old doctrines of the church. Oh, my saying, what have I to do with the sacredness of traditions? If I live wholly from within, my friend suggested, but these impulses may be from below, not from above. I replied, they do not seem to be to me to be such, but if I am the devil's child, I will live then from the devil. No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. Good and bad are but names very readily transferable to that or this. The only right is that is what is after my constitution. The only wrong, what is against it. A man is to carry himself in the presence of all opposition as if every day, or as if everything were titular and ephemeral, but he. I am ashamed to think how easily we capitulate to badges and names, to large societies and dead institutions. Every decent and well-spoken individual affects and sways me more than is right. I ought to go upright and vital, and speak the rude truth in all ways. If malice and vanity wear the coat of philanthropy, shall that pass? If an angry bigot assumes this bountiful cause of abolition and comes to me with his last news from Barbados, why should I not say to him, go love thy infant, love thy woodchopper, and be good-natured and modest. Have that grace and never varnish your hard, uncharitable ambition with this incredible tenderness for black folks 1,000 miles off. My love affair is spite at home. Thy love afar is spite at home. And rough and graceless would be such greeting. But truth is handsomer than the affection of love. Your goodness must have some edge to it, else it is none. The doctrine of hatred must be preached as the counteraction of the doctrine of love when that pules and whines. I shun father and mother and wife and brother when my genius calls me. I should write on the lintels of the doorpost, whim. I hope it is somewhat better than whim at last, but we cannot spend the day in explanation. Expect me to show cause why I seek or why I exclude company. Then again, do not tell me, as a good man did today, of my obligation to put all poor men in good situations. Are they my poor? I tell thee, thou foolish philanthropist, that I grudge the dollar, the dime, the cent I give to such men as do not belong to me and to whom I do not belong. There is a class of persons to whom by all spiritual affinity I am bought and sold. For them I will go to prison if need be. But your miscellaneous popular charities, the education at College of Fools, the building of meeting houses, the vain end to which many now stand, alms to sots, and a thousandfold relief societies, though I confess with shame, I sometimes succumb and give the dollar. It is a wicked dollar, which by and by I shall have the manhood to withhold. Virtues are, in the popular estimate, rather the exception than the rule. There is the man and his virtues. Men do what is called a good action, as some piece of courage or charity, much as they would pay a fine in expiration of daily non-appearance on parade. Their works are done as an apology or extenuation of their living in the world, as invalids and the insane pay a high board. Their virtues are penances. I do not wish to expiate, but to live. My life is for itself and not for a spectacle. I much prefer that I should be of a lower strain, so it be genuine and equal, than that it should be glittering and unsteady. I wish it to be sound and sweet, and not to need diet and bleeding. I ask the primary evidence that you are a man, and refuse this appeal from the man to his actions. I know that for myself it makes no difference whether I do or forbear those actions which are reckoned excellent. I cannot consent to pay for a privilege where I have intrinsic right. Few and mean as my gifts may be, I actually am and do not need for my own assurance or the assurance of my fellows any secondary testimony. What I must do is all that concerns me, not what people think. This rule, equally arduous and actual and in intellectual life, may serve for the whole distinction between greatness and meanness. It is the harder because you will always find those who think they know what is your duty better than you know it. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. The objection to conforming to usage conforming to usages that have become dead to you, is that it scatters your force. It loses your time and blurs the impression of your character. If you maintain a dead church, contribute to a dead Bible society, vote with a great party, either for the government or against it, spread your table like base housekeepers. Under all these screens, I have difficulty detect the precise man you are. And of course, you must force. And of course, so much force is withdrawn from your proper life. But do your work, and I shall know you. Do your work, and you shall reinforce yourself. A man must consider what a blind man's bluff is, this game of conformity. If I know your sect, I anticipate your argument. I hear a preacher announce for his text and topic the expediency of one of the institutions of his church. Do I not know beforehand that not possibly can he say a few and spontaneous words? No, or do I know that with all the ostentation of examining the grounds of the institution, he will do no such thing? Do I not know that he has pledged to himself not to look but at one side, the permitted side, not as a man, but as a parish minister? He is a retained attorney, and these heirs of the bench are the emptiest affection. While most men have bound their eyes with one or another handkerchief and attached themselves to some one of these communities of opinion, this conformity makes them not false in a few particulars, authors of a few lies, but false in all particulars. Their every truth is not quite true. Their two is not the real two. Their four, not the real four. So they every word they say chagrins us, and we know not where to begin to set them right. Meantime, nature is not so slow to equip us in the prison uniform of the party to which we adhere. We come to bear one cut of face and figure, and acquire by degree the gentlest asinine expression. There is a mortifying experience in particular, which does not fail to wreck itself also in the general history. I mean the foolish face of praise, the forced smile, which we put on in company, where we do not feel at ease, in answer to conversation which does not interest us. The muscles, not spontaneously moved, but moved by a low, usurping willfulness, grow tight about the outline of the face in the most disagreeable sensation. For nonconformity, the world whips you with its displeasure, and therefore a man must know how to estimate a sour face. The bystander look askance on him in the public street or in the friend's parlor. If this aversion had its origin in contempt and resistance, like his own, he might well go home with a sad countenance. But the sour faces of the multitude, like their sweet faces, have no deep cause, but are put on and off as the wind blows and a newspaper directs. Yet is the discontent in multitude more formidable than that of the Senate and the College? It is easy enough for a firm man who knows the world to brook the rage of the cultivated classes. Their rage is decorous and prudent, for they are timid, as being very vulnerable themselves. But when to their feminine rage the indignation of the people is added, when the ignorant and the poor are aroused, when the unintelligent brute force that lies at the bottom of society is made to growl and mow, it needs the habit of magnanimity and religion to treat it godlike as a trifle of no concernment. The other terror that scares us from self-trust is our consistency. A reverence for our past act or word because the eyes of others have no other data for computing our orbit. yet now passed Acts, and we are loath to disappoint them. Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, once we've realized who we are, then we start acting like who we are, then other people start to wonder who the hell you are. But, you know, you're you. Why should you keep your head over your shoulder? Why drag around the corpse of your memory, lest you contradict whatever you have stated in this or that public place? Suppose you should contradict yourself. What then? It seems to be a rule of wisdom never to rely on your memory alone, scarcely even in acts of pure memory, but to bring the past for judgment into the thousand-eyed present and live ever in a new day. In your metaphysics, you have denied personality to the deity, yet when the devout motions of the soul come, yield to them heart and life, though they should clothe God with shape and color. Leave your theory as Joseph's coat in the hand of the harlot and flee. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. With consistency, a great soul has simply nothing to do. He may as well concern himself with his shadow on the wall. Speak what you think now in hard words, and tomorrow speak what tomorrow thinks in hard words again, though it contradict everything you said today. Ah, so you shall be sure to be misunderstood. Is it so bad, then, to be misunderstood? Pythagoras was a misunderstood, and Socrates, and Jesus, and Luther, and Copernicus, and Galileo, and Newton, and every pure and wise spirit that ever took flesh. To be great is to be misunderstood. I suppose no man can violate his nature. All the sallies of his will are rounded in by the law of his being, as the inequalities of Andes and Himalaya are insignificant in the curve of the sphere. Nor does it matter how you gauge and try him. A character is like an acrostic or Alexandrian stanza. Read it forward, backward, or across, it still spells the same thing. In this pleasing, contrite woodlife which God allows me, let me record day by day my honest thought without prospect or retrospect, and I cannot doubt it will be found symmetrical, though I mean it not and see it not. My book should smell of pines and resound with the hum of insects. The swallow over my window should interweave that thread or straw he carries in his bill into my web also. We pass for what we are. Character teaches above our wills. Men imagine that they communicate their virtue or vice only by overt actions, and do not see the virtue or vice emit a breath every moment. There will be an agreement in whatever variety or actions, so they be each honest and natural in their hour. For of one will, the actions will be harmonious, however unlikely they seem. These varieties are lost sight of at a little distance, at a little height of thought. One tendency unites them all. The voyage of the best ship is a zigzag line of 100 tracks. See the line from a sufficient distance and a straightening itself into the average tendency. Your genuine action will explain itself and will explain your other genuine actions. Your conformity explains nothing. Act singly, and what you have already done singly will justify you now. Greatness appeals to the future. If I can be firm enough today to do right and scorn eyes, I must have done so much right before as to defend me now. Be it how it will, do right now. Always scorn appearances, and you always may. The force of character is cumulative. All the foregone days of virtue work their health into this. What makes the majesty of the heroes of the Senate in the field, which so fills the imagination, the consciousness of a train of great days and victories behind, they shed a united light on the advancing actor. He is ascended as by a visible escort of angels. That is it which throws a thunder into Chardham's voice and dignity in to Washington's port and America into Adam's eye. And honor is venerable to us because it is no ephemera. It is always ancient virtue. We worship it today because it is not of today. We love it and pay it homage because it is not a trap for our love and homage, but it is a self-dependent, self-derived, and therefore of an old, immaculate pedigree, even if shown in a young person. I hope in these days we have heard the last of conformity and consistency. Let the world be gazetted and ridiculed and ridiculous henceforth. Instead of the gong for dinner, let us hear a whistle from the Spartan fife. Let us never bow and apologize more. A great man is coming to eat at my house. Do I wish to please him? I wish that he should wish to please me. I will stand here for humility, and though I would make it kind, I would make it true. Let us affront and reprimand the smooth mediocrity and squalid contentment of the times and hurl in the face of custom and trade and office the fact which is the upshot of all history, that there is a great responsible thinker and actor working wherever a man works, that a true man belongs to no other time or place, but is the center of things. Where he is, there is nature. He measures you and all men and all events. Ordinarily, every man in society reminds us of somewhat else or of some other person. Character, reality, reminds you of nothing else. It takes place of the whole creation. The man must be so much that he must make all circumstances indifferent. Every man is a cause. A country and an age requires infinite spaces and numbers and time fully to accomplish his design, and posterity seem to follow his steps as a train of clients. A man Caesar is born, and for ages after we have a Roman Empire. Christ is born, and like millions of minds go so grow and cleave to his genius that he is confounded with the virtue and the possible of man. In an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man, as monasticism of the hermit Anthony, the Reformation of Luther, Quakerism of Fox, Methodism of Wesley, abolition of Clarkston, Scipio, Milton, called the height of Rome, and all history revolves inside very easily, revolves itself very easily into the biography of a few stout and earnest persons. Fascinating. We remember all the great men because they all took stances, and either they were hated or loved or both. But that's the way of self-reliance. Let a man then know his worth and keep things under his feet. Let him not peep or steal or skulk up and down with the air of a charity boy, a bastard, or an interloper in the world which exists for him. But the man in the street, finding no worth in himself which corresponds to the force which built a tower or sculpted a marble god, feels poor when he looks on these. To him, a palace, a statue, or a costly book have an alien and forbidding air, much like a gay equipage, and seem to say like that, "Who are you, sir?" Yet they all are his suitors for his notice, petitioners to his facilities, that they will come out and take possession. The picture waits for my verdict. it is not to command me, but I am to settle its claim to praise. That popular fable of the sot who was picked up dead drunk in the street, carried to the Duke's house, washed and dressed and laid in the Duke's bed, and on his waking, treated with all obsequious ceremony, like the Duke, and assured that he had been insane, owes its popularity to the fact that it symbolizes so well the state of man who is in the world a sort of sot, but now and then awakens up, exercises his reason, and finds himself a true prince. Our reading is Mendicant and Sycophantic. In history, our imagination plays us false. Kingdom and lordship, power and estate are a gaudier vocabulary, with Private John and Edward in a small house and common day's work. But the things of life are the same to both. The sum total of both is the same. Why all this difference to Alfred and Skanderberg and Gustavus? Suppose they were virtuous. Did they wear out virtue? As great a stake depends on your private act today as followed their public and renowned steps. When private men shall act with original views, the luster will be transferred from the actions of the kings to those of gentlemen. The world has been instructed by its kings, who have so magnetized the eyes of nations. It has been taught by this colossal symbol, the mutual reverence that is due from man to man, the joyful loyalty with which men have everywhere suffered the king, the noble, or the great proprietor to walk among them by a law of his own, make his own scale of men and things, and reverse theirs. Pay for benefits not with money but with honor, and represent the law in his person, was the hieroglyphic by which they obscurely signified their consciousness of their own right and comeliness, the right of every man. So the right of every man was usurped by the royalty, by the elitists who manipulated things and that their wisdom was much greater, and they formed together and created these the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the UN, and all these other absurd things. Now, they thought there was more power in group than there was in individuals, but there wasn't. There isn't. The magnetism which all original action exerts is explained when we inquire the reason of self-trust. Who is the trustee? What is the aboriginal self on which a universal reliance may be grounded? What is the nature and power of that science-baffling star without parallax, without calculable elements, which shoot a ray of beauty even into the trivial and impure actions if the least mark of the independence appears? The inquiry leads us to that source at once the essence of genius, of virtue, and of life, which we call spontaneity or instinct. We denote this primary wisdom as institution, or rather intuition, whilst all latter teachings are tuitions. In the deep force, the last fact behind which analysis cannot go, all things find their common origin. For the sense of being which in calm hours rises, we know not how in the soul, is not diverse from things from space, from light, from time, from man, but one with them and proceeds obviously from the same source whence their life and being also proceed. We first share the life by which things exist and afterwards see them as appearances in nature, and forget that they have shared their cause. Here is the fountain of action and of thought. Here are the lungs of that inspiration which giveth man wisdom, and which cannot be denied without impiety and atheism. We lie in the laps of immense intelligence, which makes us receivers of its truth and organs of its activity. When we discern justice, when we discern truth, we do nothing of ourselves, but allow a passage to its beams. If we ask whence this comes, if we seek to pry into the soul that causes all philosophy, is at fault. Its presence or its absence is all we can affirm. Every man discriminates between the voluntary act of his mind and his involuntary perceptions, and knows that to his involuntary perceptions a perfect faith is due. He may err in the expression of them, but he knows that these things are so, like day and night, not to be disputed. My willful actions and acquisitions are but roving. The idlest reverie, the faintest native emotion, command of my curiosity and respect. Thoughtless people contradict as readily the statement of the perceptions as of opinions, or rather much more readily, for they do not distinguish between perception and notion. They fancy that I choose to see this or that thing, but perception is not whimsical, but fatal. If I see a trait, my children will see it after me, and in course of time, all mankind, although it may chance that no one has seen it before me, for my perception of it is as much a fact as the sun. The relation of the soul to the divine spirit are so pure that it is profane to seek to interpose helps. It must be that when God speaketh, he should communicate not one thing, but all things, should fill the world with his voice, should scatter forth light, nature, time, souls from the center of the present thought, and new dates and new create, and new date and new create the whole. Whenever a mind is simple and receives a divine wisdom, all things pass away, means, teachers, texts, temples fall. It lives now and absorbs past and future into the present hour. All things are made sacred by relation to it, one as much as another. All things are dissolved to their center by their cause, and in the universal miracle, petty and particular miracles disappear. If therefore a man claims to know and speak of God and carries you backwards to the phraseology of some old molded nation in another country, in another world, believe him not. Is the acorn better than the oak, which is its fullness and completion? Is the parent better than the child into whom he was cast his ripened being? Whence then this worship of the past? The centuries are conspirators against the sanity and authority of the soul. Type and space are but psychological colors which the eyes make, but the soul is light. Where is it? Is day. Where it is, or rather where it was, is night. And history is an impertinence and an injury, if it be anything more than a cheerful apologue or parable of my being and coming. So damn all history, you know. Damn history. Never thought I'd look to see that or say that, but damn history. I have about 15 minutes left. I don't think I'm going to get through the whole thing in 60 minutes, but I'll attempt it. And we'll see where we can. And see how far I can last reading. It's a difficult text in a way. And I've read it many, many, many times, but it's still rather difficult to grasp the lexicon, because this was written in 1836 or 37 or something, or maybe later. And people talked differently then. They wrote differently then. And trying to capture that dialect, if you will, or not dialect even, but trying to capture that the tone, the sincerity, the intent of a man who lived 200 years ago, very difficult to imagine. But after many, many readings of this over the years, I found myself catching many, many different angles and, or, you know, many phrases in this text that just swept me away into a validation of what he's stating, a universal law that he's promoting here, that he's trying to explain. And explain it does. I so many things, but in the time that we have remaining, which is if you get nothing from this essay, my reading, try to understand that if we trust ourselves, which is a big thing to do, but if we trust ourselves and trust our intuition, we will know who we are. We will be able to get up in the morning knowing who we are, going to the mirror, you know, brushing your teeth, knowing you are that person, knowing what you like and what you dislike about that person. Things that, you know, maybe you can do better. But as you take on your true personality, your true personality really wants to shine. It really wants to grow with you. It wants to be enhanced. And it wants to, it doesn't want to conform to society. It wants to break away. And by so doing, it alienates itself and causes difficulty amongst the family members and also amongst, you know, your peers, workplace, what type of work you're able to get. You know, being self-reliant, or being a non-conformist, regardless of how non-conformist you are, that's a good thing. You know, just be there. You know that you are that person. Don't try to be a person. Just be the person. Just be whoever it is. It shouldn't be a task. It shouldn't be hard to be who you are. But that seems to be a problem for a lot of people. But in the essence of the people who have to make great decisions, or may influence many people, or may think they are right, we bow to them in respect, because they have proven by listening to themselves that what they have to say is as valid and as important as what the next guy has to say. And for that reason, we can listen, we can tune out, we can tune in what it is. And that's what we have to trust. We just have to trust in faith, but in the knowledge that we are able to command the universe, individually command the universe, individually, not do that, the interesting thing, the miracle is that when we do that, what we are doing is we are accessing the intuition, and accessing the intuition is accessing the universal intelligence and law that abides within us. So that by doing so, we are, in a sense, I believe we're conforming, probably to the maximum, however, through non-conformity. That was a strange thing, but you know, society creates it and wants us to conform to their whims. Individuals want to conform to a higher calling, you know, that of their own belief and their own belief system they feel is right. And unfortunately, many of our errors don't come from what we think is wrong or right, but what we believe others think is wrong or right, and then listen to them, even though we may know all along which is what is right and wrong to do. There are certain instincts that we know, you know, but there are certain things that we are told, like rattlesnakes bite and can kill you if you don't have the proper serum. That's been told to us as a warning from people who have been bitten by rattlesnakes and, or whatever kind of snake, and labeled it and said, this is a poisonous snake. Stay away from it. And, you know, for that, we have our brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers in previous society that have proven many things. But if we decide to stand up to certain elements that don't make sense to us, you know, that don't make sense to us, regardless of who said it, regardless of Emerson said it or Socrates said it or anybody said it, we have the right to express our own views on these issues and understand them. And if we can understand them, it's only because we're understanding them from the center of our being, the source, the soul. And in essence, rather, that's what metaphysics are. That's how we develop metaphysics, and that we, things we believe in and we understand, even though we don't physically see. And that, again, that's a lecture for another night. But with the remaining time that I have, maybe I can highlight, I won't be able to finish, but I'll highlight a couple of things that I've underlined in this in these essays. Life only avails, not the having lived. Power ceases in the instance of repose. It resides in the moment of transition from past to a present, to a new state. In the shooting of the gulf, in the dating of to an aim, this one fact the world hates, that the soul becomes, for that forever degrades the past, turns all riches to poverty, all reputation to shame, and confounds the saint with the rogue, shoves Jesus and Judas equally aside. Why then do we prate of self-reliance? Inasmuch as the soul is present, there will be power, not confident, but agent. To talk of self-reliance is a poor external way of speaking. Speak rather of that which relies because it works and is. Who has more obedience than I, Master, me? Though he should not raise his finger. Round him I must revolve by the gravitation of spirits. We fancy it rhetoric when we speak of eminent virtue. We do not see that virtue is height, and that a man or a company of men, plastic and permeable, the principles by the law of nature must overpower and ride all cities, nations, kings, rich men, poets, who are not. This is the ultimate fact which we so quickly reach on this, as on every topic, the resolution of all into the ever-blessed one. Self-existence is the attribute of the supreme cause, and it constitutes the measure of good by the degree in which it enters into all lower forms. All things real are not are so, but so much virtue as they contain. Commerce, husbandry, hunting, whaling, war, eloquence, personal weight, are somewhat and engaged in respect as examples of its presence and in pure action. I see the same law working in the nature, for growth and for conservation and growth. Power is in nature the essential measure of right. Nature suffers nothing to remain in her kingdoms, which cannot help itself. The genesis and maturation of planet, its poise and orbit, the bended tree recovering itself from the strong wind, and the vital resources of every animal and vegetable are demonstrations of the self-sufficing and therefore self-relying soul. Thus all concentrates, let us not rove. Let us sit at home with the cause. Let us stun and astonish the intruding rabble of men and books and institutions by a simple declaration of the divine fact. Bid the invader take the shoes from off their feet, for God is here within. Let our simplicity judge them, and our docility to our own law demonstrate the poverty of nature and fortune beside our native riches. But now we are a mob. The mob does not stand in awe of men, nor in his genius admonished to stay at home, to put itself in communication with the internal ocean, but it goes abroad to beg a cup of water or of the urines of other men. We must go alone. I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. How far off, how cool, how chaste the persons look, begirt each one with a precinct or sanctuary. So let us always sit. Why should we assume the faults of our friends, our wife, or father, or church, because they sit around our hearth, or are said to have the same blood? All men have my blood, and I all men's. Not for that will I adopt their petulance or folly, even to the extent of being ashamed of it. But your isolation must not be mechanical, but spiritual. That is, must be elevation. At times, the whole world seems to be in conspiracy to importune you with emphatic trifles. Friends, clients, child, sickness, fear, want, charity, all knock at once at my closet door and say, "Come not unto us." But keep they state. Come out into their confusion. The power men possess to annoy me, I give them by a weak curiosity. No man can come near me, but through my act. What we love, that we have, but by desire we bereave ourselves of the love. If we cannot at once rise to the sanctities of obedience and faith, let us at least resist our temptations, and let us enter into the state of war and wake Thor and Woden. Courage and constancy in our Saxon beasts. This is to be done in our smooth times by speaking the truth. Check this lying hospitality and lying affection. Live no longer the expectation of these deceived and the deceiving people with whom we converse. Say to them, O father, O mother, O wife, O brother, O friend, I have lived with you after appearances hitherto. Henceforth, I am the truth. Be it known unto you that henceforth I obey no law less than the eternal law. I will have no convents but proximities. I shall endeavor to nourish my parents, to support my family, to be the chaste husband of one wife. But these relations I must fill after a new and unprecedented way. I appeal from your customs. I must be myself. I cannot break myself any longer for you or you. If you can love me for what I am, we shall be the happier. If you cannot, I will still seek to deserve that you should. I will not hide my tastes or aversions. Okay, and we got 12 seconds. before we stream ends. And I think I'm going to stop there. I thought of going further time, but that's pretty quite still long. I'll finish next week. Thank you, and good night. Join us tomorrow night with George Dixon as we track another case in the Mayan calendar. And we expose a few more truths in the prophecy. So good night, and thank you for listening.